So the next talk is the FELS longitudinal study. Shumei Sun, professor and chair of the Department of Biostatistics at the Medical College of Virginia.
Thank you, and good morning. I will be talking about the FELS longitudinal study. And before I start, I would like to thank the organizing committee for putting together such a wonderful forum for us to contribute our expertise and to share with everybody, and for us also to learn from our expertise of others. So I'm very honored and very grateful that to be able to attend this meeting. So on this slide, what I'm listing is are the investigators and collaborators. If I can divide kind of roughly the scope of the work, in the Virginia side, we are focusing on the analysis and model building. And at Rice State, Rice State is in Ohio, our investigators focus on the measurements. And at Virginia side, we have Roy Sable, who is sitting over there. Roy Sable's expertise is in the efficient modeling of the heterogeneity of intrafamily dependence. And Yongyun Shin's expertise is in multi-level hierarchical modeling for the incomplete data set. And Chunwang Gao, his expertise is in Granger causality, temporal relationship and causal network. So for me to talk about the FELS longitudinal study, I really have to start by telling you a little history of the FELS study, because that to a greater extent, it's driving the design of the study. Then I'll share with you some of the research finding and the statistical methods that we used. And then we have some future direction, but I'm looking forward to learn more how to expand our future direction, especially in the social network and in the psychosocial aspects of the modeling. So the FELS longitudinal study began in 1929 by Arthur Morgan. Arthur Morgan was the president of Antioch College in Yellow Spring, Ohio. And Arthur Morgan posed a question, what makes people different? And he approached Samuel Fels to seek funding for the study. And he also postulated that a longitudinal study is necessary to attempt to address the question. And at that time, the scientists or biologists, sociologists, psychologists, they are skeptical of such a longitudinal study would be of any values, but Arthur Morgan has the backing of Samuel Fels to establish the Fels Research Institute. That's when the study began. And Samuel Fels was a Philadelphia philanthropist. He made a fortune out of soap manufacturing. And he supported Arthur Morgan to establish the study, and not only the study per se, there's a huge research institute that I will discuss later what kind of measurements we have. But in the studies, each cohort were enrolled at birth, and after they were enrolled, they were seen every 3 months for the first 18 months, and then twice every 6 months until the participants turned 18. And after 18, they were scheduled to visit the clinic every 2 years. And the study at this point continues, and with the study, it generates several fundings. And I mentioned about the FELS Research Institute and the FELS Longitudinal Study. Until 1976, the FELS Foundation retract their funding for our study, so we began to seek NIH funding, and we are very grateful that we continue to get the funding from NICHD, and has been support us for 20, 30 years, and Terry is sitting there. We're very happy that we still have the funding to do the work, but as the year goes by, we get funding from NHLBI, the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and we also get funding from NIDDK, and some funding from Cancer Institute. So I forgot to mention, yeah, we also have multi-generation families. I will discuss the structure of the study. But this, back that time, the goal is to answer the question, what makes people different? So there is really no hypothesis. We just want to see what makes people different. And Arthur Morgan even was just trying to attempt to answer the question, what makes people different? So just to give you an idea, where is the Yellow Springs in Ohio where there's a study? If you look at the pink, do we have the pointer?
Yeah.
This one?
The pink here, this is the state of Ohio. Yellow Springs is about southwest of Ohio, nearby Dayton. So this is where the study starts.
And this is the soap that Samuel Fells made the fortune from. It's a bright, it's a Fells knocked-up heavy-duty laundry soap. I wonder if you are old enough to remember this kind of soap. When I go by to Dayton Airport, I sometimes can still get the soap. But it was, the fortune was made out of this kind of soap. It was used very popular. And Samuel Fells has a theory. He thinks that to manufacture and market something that has to be used quickly and has to be repurchased quickly. That's how he made a fortune. And we really are very grateful to him for his vision and to his interest and generosity to support such a study. The Fells was supported between 1929 to 1974, and some partial funding continues until 1982. The Fells Foundation told our investigator, don't come to me anymore. Try to get funding through NIH or other agencies. So, and we did, and we're still trying to. So you've seen this map before, but the purpose of this map is to show you the geographical distribution of the Fells participants, where they live. Of course, everybody moved from time to time, and so do the Fells participants. And the number shows in here are the participants. Of course, these was done like 10 years ago. We have the sample almost, I would say, about 20% to 30% increase now. But again, majority of the participants still live in Ohio, and about 60% to 70%, and 10% moved to Florida, and some moved to California. So, but the key thing is we have the funding to pay for their way to the clinic for the visit, and so we have a comprehensive measurement of these people. And what's interesting is that the people who belong to the to a family, so we sometimes have six or seven people come back to our clinic for visits. And it's not uncommon that in the Christmas or Thanksgiving time, it's the most busiest time for us because we have a bunch of family coming for the visits. So now I want to talk about the design of the study. Look at the horizontal axis is the year of birth, and the age in years, vertical axis. And each oblique line trace the cohort as they become older. So this is 80 years of worth of data. So it created a tremendous opportunity for data analysis. For example, if I cut across horizontally, let's say between 10 to 20, then we have individuals who were the same age but born at different decade. So that allow us to look at secular trend. And if you look at the data vertically, let's say cut a slice on year 1989, you have individuals of different ages. Then allow you to look at the data cross-sectionally. And But the most important, the most contribution the study can give is the tracing individual over time, the oblique lines, because that allow us to look at the temporal changes, temporal relationship, and also the causal relationship, and individual life course, exposure to environment, and the family's members allow us to look at genetics aspect of it, so gene and environment interactions. And this slide shows the age distribution of the participants from birth to more than 80 years, and males, females, almost equally divided. And right now, for the measurement we are taking right now, we have about 3,000 individuals with serial data, and that come from about 1,200 families. And we have also, let me see, about 300 extended family. When I say 1,100 families, those are nuclear families, okay? And measurements. The measurement list here are the measurement we are currently taking now. And for the first 5 decades, the majority of the measurements are anthropometric measurements, weight, height, weight circumference, skin folds, circumference at various sites, and plus blood pressure. There are also psychosocial data, stress, and IQ data that's still locked in a drawer in the basement of our clinic. They were not analyzed. We also have 7-day dietary records, serial dietary records, the mothers who write down what their baby eats, what their toddler eats, very extensive dietary records, still locked in the drawers of our basement. So for the last 3 decades, we gradually expand the measurements that include body compositions, bioelectric impedance, underwater weighing techniques, and dual energy X-ray absorptiometry. In addition, we do fasting blood drawing to get the blood chemistries, lipids, lipoproteins, glucose, insulin, and markers of inflammation, leptin, adult leptin, and CRP, and some sexual hormones, sex hormones, a number of sex hormones, and also IGF binding protein, IGF, that kind of measurements. In addition, we have cardiovascular risk factors, echocardiography, it's a measure of heart size and function, and a cardiopulmonary fitness test. And in addition to all these physiological measurements, we also have questionnaires data. We collect questionnaire data for the tenor staging of sexual maturation. We also take X-ray of hand wrist using the 16 indicators on the hand wrist to estimate the skeletal age semi-annually. And right now, we start to collect the aging-related data, SF36 and fracture, that kind of information. In addition to all this physiological questionnaire data, we also have family history data, medical history, and lifestyle, including physical activity, dietary intake, alcohol consumption, smoking. So this is a picture of underwater weighing tank. The concept comes from the Archimedes volumetric displacement. So from underwater weighing tank, underwater weight allow you to obtain the body volume. From body volume, we can obtain body density. And body density, based on the difference between the density of fat and lean, we can obtain fat and lean from underwater weighing. And this used to be the gold standard until 1989, when the dual energy X-ray absorptiometry was developed. This is one of the Fells participants who was measured in his lumbar spine and hip spine. But this machine has two different levels of energy X-ray sources. with the different energy that allow you to penetrate bone and soft tissue in a different way. And based on the differences, we can obtain the bone mineral density of individuals. And the machine now become sophisticated enough, we can also obtain the fat and the lean. So this machine allow you to have total body measurements and regional measurements of bone, fat, and lean. So we talk about longitudinal study. This is an observational study. Longitudinal study, we don't intervene. We only refer to the patients that they need to see their physician, family doctor, if we experience some problems in the participants, but we don't have any intervention. So what I want to show you is the natural changes, pattern of change in body mass index. On the blue line here, this is a very general pattern of body mass index from birth to, in this case, I have up to 25 years. Body mass index decrease at the beginning and reach a nadir, and then after it reach a nadir, it's increase. So the nadir A here is a landmark. It's called a positive rebound. Some people like to call it BMI rebound because BMI do not quite reflect percent body fat. So this rebound is important in its timing of occurrence. The earlier the rebound occur, the more likely for the individual become obese later in life. And there have been several studies showing that, and also including our study. And the lower bottom is the lower curve, a purple curve, is just the velocity of that body mass index. So we talked about secular trend before. Here, what I want to show you is the secular trend. Showing here are the percentage of individual in the extended family whose BMI value exceeds 75th percentiles of U.S. national growth charts. The red line is the individual born between 1980 and 2005. And the green is 1960 and 1980. And the blue is 1940 and 1960. So you can see a significant increase in the obesity or overweight. So there is a clear secular trend. Now, this is just an example to show you what kind of data we have. There's what shows here is a percentage of population ever smoking, plotted by males and females from 10 to 26 years of age. The next one is the average physical activity, serial data for physical activity, plotted from 6 to 26 years of age, separated by males and females, and fitted with a polynomial curve. So the FELS data has been used to generate the national growth charts, and it was used worldwide between 1977 until year 2000, when National Center for Health Statistics at the U.S. decided to revise the growth charts. So if you go to pediatric clinic, you may see this kind of chart that the nurse plotted your child's weight, height, and length data on this kind of chart. So those are data from us. Wait a minute. I should go back. How do we go back? Previous? Yeah. Okay. When the revision of the growth chart happened, I was involved in the development of the new revised growth charts. Still, the first 3 years of the HESO conference data comes from the FELS participants. And the pattern of change from birth to 2 months, the pattern is simulating the FELS participants. So we still using part of the FELS data for the national growth charts. And the reason we revised the growth charts is because of the FELS is a longitudinal study. It's located in southwestern Ohio. It's not representative of the national population. So I turn my attention to...
Can you wrap it up because we're over time, 2 minutes maybe?
That's quick. Okay. So I will skip this pie chart, metabolic syndrome, but I just want to show you quickly. Metabolic syndrome is a definition. The definition is by National Cholesterol Education Program, Adult Treatment Panel 3, that if you have five risk factors out of the five, at least there are three factors exceed the defined cut points, then you have metabolic syndrome. And that is a definition for adults. So what we did is with the power of longitudinal studies, you can look at what happened adults now with adults. You look at those who has metabolic syndrome, those who do not have metabolic syndrome, and then you can look back to their childhood values. And this is the slide shows their childhood values for body mass index. The red curves are the adults who have metabolic syndrome, their childhood body mass index. The blue curves are those who have not yet developed metabolic syndrome. And I just want to point it out, these adults are age matched, so there's no age effect. So you can see metabolic syndrome, children who has higher BMI value destined to develop metabolic syndrome. And the difference occur at age 3 for males, and the difference occur at age 9. So I also have several data for the waist circumference and for blood pressure, lipids, lipoprotein. So I'm not going to talk about this. I'm trying to wrap this up. But my final slides, which I want to show, is the direction. What we want to do next step is to validate the self-reported disease with hospital records and to identify participants with disease through hospital records and being able to have much more definitive data for the endpoint, the disease, morbidity and mortality, so that we can relate the childhood value to adult values. In addition, I'm hoping through this workshop we can learn some more psychosocial related information. We do have a lot of psychosocial information, but those are old. Those are between 1930 to 1960, 1970. Okay, I'll stop here. Okay, thank you.
I guess we should go to the next speaker.